Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bahar Azmi of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who expresses concern that the recent Supreme Court decision allowing strip searches of persons for minor offenses could lead to systematic abuse by police officials. Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center, who describes the reduced number of executions across the U.S. as Connecticut is poised to become the 17th state to end capital punishment. And ColorOfChange.org's Rashad Robinson, who talks about his group's campaign to pressure corporations to drop their membership in the right-wing policy group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Days after the April 1st election in Myanmar, swept by Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy, the Obama White House moved to ease sanctions against the Southeast Asian nation, also known as Burma. Among the moves announced by the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the United States will lift a travel ban on senior Burmese leaders and reopen an office of the U.S. Agency for International Development to fund relief projects. The European Union is also moving to lift sanctions imposed on Myanmar, isolated after violent crackdowns against pro-democracy activists in 1988 and 2007. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy won 43 of the 44 legislative contests it entered. The party won in districts dominated by government civil service workers and the military. Still, the opposition only controls 5% of the seats in parliament, dominated by former military officers and the ruling Union Solidarity Development Party. President Thein Sein's negotiations with Aung San Suu Kyi last summer led to the release of hundreds of political prisoners, the easing of censorship, and peace talks with ethnic minority rebel groups. Soon after, the National League of Democracy re-entered politics. In the coming months, Myanmar is expected to strengthen ties to the U.S. and open its doors to international investors interested in exploiting the nation's rich natural resources. But environmental and human rights activists are calling for investors to respect international labor, environmental, and human rights law and give civil society a full voice in development decisions. Due to what they claim are mounting losses caused by the recession and improved fuel economy of American cars, the Sunoco Oil Company is threatening to shut down its oil refinery in Philadelphia by July 1st if it can't find a buyer to take over the plant's operations. If the refinery closes during the peak of the summer driving season, it could lead to a spike in prices along the East Coast up to $5 a gallon. Sunoco says there are a few interested buyers, and if the refinery closes, replacement gasoline supplies would have to be shipped from the Gulf Coast or Europe. According to the Christian Science Monitor, a number of oil refineries serving the U.S. East Coast have recently closed, including the Hess Terminal in the Virgin Islands and the ConocoPhillips facility in Trainer, Pennsylvania. Making matters worse, pipeline capacity is maxed out for transporting gasoline to the East Coast until a new pipeline comes online in 2013. Predictably, the oil industry is blaming its problems on the Obama administration for demanding that oil companies produce cleaner fuels. However, the biggest factor is the decline in consumer demand for gasoline over the past year, a drop of 5 to 7% since last spring. Overall, U.S. refineries have a glut of gasoline and are now exporting it to overseas markets. Consumer demand is expected to decline further as new car mileage standards go into effect. By 2016, the average new car must get 34 miles per gallon, which could cut demand for gasoline by 13% within the next decade, an amount equal to the output of 18 refineries. Federal drug agents raided the home and office of prominent medical marijuana activist Richard Lee in Oakland, California, sending shockwaves through the drug reform movement. It was the latest evidence of an aggressive campaign launched by the U.S. Justice Department targeting medical marijuana shops in California and Colorado. Voters in California approved marijuana for medical use 16 years ago. Oakland is the epicenter of the medical marijuana movement in California, where the city issues permits and taxes cannabis outlets. Lee, a paraplegic since a 1990 injury, set up Oaksterdam University in 2007 and used his marijuana profits to push a referendum to legalize and tax marijuana as a recreational drug. Proposition 19 lost at the polls in 2010, but it mainstreamed the issue of legalizing the sale of cannabis. The raids by the Drug Enforcement Administration and Internal Revenue Service were seen by advocates as politically motivated. Last October, federal prosecutors sent 300 letters to landlords of dispensaries in California and Colorado ordering the eviction of medical marijuana shops. And the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation seized bank accounts linked to marijuana sales. In 2009, Deputy U.S. Attorney David Ogden promised not to target people who were in clear compliance with state medical marijuana laws. California's Attorney General has ruled medical marijuana dispensaries must be run as nonprofit collectives. However, Richard Lee disagreed, maintaining that California law allows medical marijuana shops to be run as for-profit businesses. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In a 5-4 ruling on April 2nd, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that allows security officials in American jails to strip search any person arrested on serious or minor offenses without reasonable suspicion that the person may be concealing contraband. The case, Florence v. County of Burlington, stemmed from the 2005 New Jersey arrest of Albert Florence, an African American, who was a passenger in his car that his wife was driving when state police pulled the vehicle over to issue her a speeding ticket. When officers found that there was an outstanding warrant for Mr. Florence due to an unpaid traffic fine, he was arrested. Although records later found that the fine had been paid 2 years earlier, Florence was held for a week in two jails and subjected to humiliating strip searches in each facility. In their ruling, the justices found that persons placed into a jail's general population for minor offenses, such as not stopping in a red light, violating pet leash laws, driving a car with a noisy muffler, or riding a bicycle without an audible bell, can be stripped of their clothing and have their body cavities searched by jail guards. Writing for the majority opinion, Justice Anthony M. Kennedy said the court should not second-guess prison officials and cited the arrest of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh for a traffic violation. Writing for the dissenting minority, Justice Stephen J. Breyer found that there was little evidence to support the conclusion that strip searches would detect contraband that would not have been otherwise found by jail officials using less invasive methods. He cited a study that found of the 23,000 people admitted to a correctional facility in Orange County, New York, there was only one instance of contraband found by a strip search that otherwise would have been missed. Your reporter spoke with Bahar Azmi, legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who expresses concern that the ruling in this case could lead to a systematic abuse by police officials.
First, I think it's interesting that this decision was issued, you know, right around the time of the oral arguments relating to the Affordable Health Care Act. And, you know, we don't know what Justice Kennedy will do with the Health Care Act, but it signals a very, I think, distorted vision of by the conservatives on the court of what constitutes liberty, because in some of their view, having to pay a penalty if you don't sign up for health insurance is such a fundamental deprivation of liberty that a national program, 40 years in development, can be struck down. But exposure of one's genitals in connection with an arrest, a wrongful arrest in this particular case, without reasonable suspicion of any danger, that is not a sufficient enough deprivation of liberty to invoke constitutional protections. So it's a disappointing decision, and I think ultimately members of the court wanted to defer to jail officials based on some anecdotal evidence that in some cases even nonviolent individuals who are arrested for utterly nonviolent crimes may somehow possess a weapon or be carrying a disease.
There's some concern, of course, that this Supreme Court ruling could open the door for the use of strip search as a method of sexual humiliation of any particular group that police wanted to target. It further could also be used to intimidate protesters engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience in an effort to dissuade them from future dissenting activities. What's your concern about how this ruling could be abused by police officials across the country?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I am skeptical about the genuine penological or public health purpose for these kinds of prison inspections. I think they are done as a matter of course for the purposes of social control and humiliation and sort of to destroy someone psychologically as they're entering the system, regardless of any prediction of whether or not they're dangerous. And in that sense, it also has a troubling overlap with the view of the handling of detainees and, you know, by the Bush administration. That is, you know, psychological destruction and humiliation is paramount in early interaction with the police. And this can surely be used. I mean, someone might be willing to spend the night in the tank, you know, as part of a lawful protest. It might be a heck of a lot harder if you're being, you know, strip searched by police officers just before that night in the tank.
Are there remedies out there for this? I know that there are at least 10 states that have a prohibition on strip searching those arrested in minor crimes. How does this Supreme Court decision affect those state laws? And could the prohibition on strip searches be extended to other states around the country who want to prevent that kind of a treatment of people arrested on minor offenses?
It's a very important question. So all this decision says is it's not unconstitutional for the jail officials to engage in this kind of behavior. The Supreme Court, its defense, is not necessarily saying it's good policy. And so states could pass laws that prohibit jail officials from engaging in strip searches in any circumstances the majority of the people of a particular state wish. And this decision wouldn't affect that. It merely permits a state to use it. It doesn't prohibit a state from outlawing these practices. And I hope this causes concerned individuals to ask their legislators to pass these kind of protections, because it really now could happen to anyone in an interaction with the police that leads to an arrest.
The examples that were discussed in the case were amazing. People with a noisy muffler, people who didn't have an audible bell on their bicycle, spitting on the sidewalk, people violating leash laws, walking their dogs, could all be arrested, hauled into a jail and strip searched. It's quite crazy and frightening
including
all at the same
time. Including Mr. Florence himself, who was pulled over for supposedly not having paid off a bench warrant, which he in fact paid and tried to prove to the police at that point that he had paid. It's just a sort of acceptance of a level of police and prison intervention in our lives that is really sort of verging on total.
That was Bahar Azmi, legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Find links to more perspectives on the Supreme Court's strip search decision on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 5th, the Connecticut State Senate voted 20-16 to abolish the death penalty. It's expected to pass in the House, and Governor Daniel Malloy has promised to sign the measure. If, as expected, the bill becomes law, Connecticut will join 16 other states in the District of Columbia in ending the death penalty, and the fifth in the last 5 years to do so. Opponents of capital punishment argue that its use is discriminatory by race and judicial district, with those who are convicted of killing whites more likely to be sentenced to death than those convicted of killing African Americans or Latinos. Critics also note that one district attorney in Waterbury prosecuted about half the death penalty cases in the entire state. Unlike many other states abolishing the death penalty, Connecticut's legislation is prospective, not retrospective, meaning that if the bill becomes law, the status of 11 men currently on death row will not change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. He describes the national landscape for abolition and explains that both death sentences and executions are down sharply across the nation, even as a majority of Americans continue to support the death penalty.
There has been a a steady decrease in the use of the death penalty in the past decade. Death sentences have dropped about 75%, and we're down to 78 last year compared to about 300 a year in the 90s. Executions have also dropped by more than half. There were 98 executions at the end of the 1990s, and last year there were 43. This also is reflected in the size of death row, which is now down to about 3,100 inmates. So by all usual measures, including the number of states that retain the death penalty, the death penalty is being used less and reconsidered by many states.
And Texas is in that category, too, which used to have a phenomenally high number of executions. But that was before the state had the option of a life sentence without the possibility of release. Do you think there's a connection?
It seems to be. I mean, it was just the timing is very clear. They adopted life without parole. They were the last death penalty state to do so in 2005. So crimes committed after that, which would mean 2007, 2008, you know, would be eligible for life without parole for the first time. And so that's when the death sentences have dropped from more than 40 in a year to 8 in 1 year last year. So it's a considerable drop. Other states also have life without parole. All the death penalty states now have life without parole as an alternative sentence. So we're seeing more use of that, coupled with the fact that jurors recognize that the death sentence carries a risk of new information being revealed that might upset a conviction years later.
The other thing Connecticut Democrats did to get a majority in the Senate was say that those sentenced to life without release will exist in the same conditions as death row prisoners, isolated in solitary confinement in their cells 22 hours a day and, you know, with other restrictions. Meanwhile, 57 other inmates already sentenced to life without parole are in general population in a prison in Connecticut. So there seems to be some unequal treatment.
The death penalty, in theory at least, picks not just those eligible for life, but the worst of the worst, and those people need special segregation from the rest of the population or special protection for the guards. And so for those people, the ones who would have been sentenced to death, not just those who get life, there's this need for this special form of retribution, I guess.
The latest poll of Connecticut residents on the issue showed that 62% are in favor of the death penalty, but the question didn't ask about the option of life without release. Do you know what the sentiment is nationally?
Yeah, very close. The latest Gallup poll, which just asked the same question, yes or no on the death penalty, was 61% in support of the death penalty. But Gallup also occasionally asks to compare life without parole versus the death penalty, and then it's about an even 48% each. Life and death respondent is given the life without parole. So that people want to hear that, you know, that form of punishment and maybe even something extra, such as what Connecticut added, and then they are willing to let the death penalty go, or at least close to a majority are. But if you just ask about the death penalty theoretically, most people don't have a moral objection to it, that is to say, you know, over 60%. But what we're seeing is that states are, five now in 5 years, if Connecticut passes, abolishing the death penalty and replacing it with life without parole. They feel that that is sufficient and avoids these risks of mistake and unfairness when it comes to life and death. So, you know, it's a different question when you give some alternatives, which is what legislators had before them, which is what jurors have before them. And so I think that's more the proper question.
The argument against the death penalty used to be a purely moral one, but more recently, abolitionists have been giving an economic argument that because of the almost never-ending appeals, death row inmates often stay on death row for decades. Was that the main argument in these other four states that abolished the death penalty in the last 5 years?
Hard to say Maine, but it certainly was a part of the discussion in all of those states. The governor of New Mexico, Governor Richardson, said that, you know, he was on the fence, but that costs was really a new and important argument for him. The Illinois bill not only abolished the death penalty, but established that money from a fund that used to go to the death penalty would go towards fighting crime. So it's not just costs, but costs and lack of any result or product or benefit to society.
That was Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Learn more about groups campaigning to end capital punishment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a group unfamiliar to most Americans, came into public view in early 2011 as a number of states across the U.S. were debating and passing legislation eliminating the collective bargaining rights of public sector labor unions, including Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. News reports revealed that ALEC, a right-wing policy group funded by some of the nation's largest corporations, not only promoted the anti-union bills, but provided conservative legislators in more than a dozen states with model legislative language to get the job done. ALEC, whose membership is made up of both corporations and legislators, works mostly behind the scenes to advance laws that benefit the agenda of its corporate funders. The group has written legislation to impose discriminatory voter ID laws, harsher criminal penalties on juveniles, privatized education, permissive stand-your-ground gun laws, and severe anti-immigration measures. In all, the American Legislative Exchange Council boasts that nearly 1,000 of its model bills are introduced in state legislatures each year, with hundreds enacted. The nation's largest African-American online civil rights group, ColorOfChange.org, has helped lead a campaign to expose ALEC's agenda and to pressure corporations to end their membership and support for the group. So far, they've succeeded in pushing Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Kraft, McDonald's, and Intuit to drop their membership, but members like the billionaire Koch brothers and Walmart are standing firm in their support for ALEC. Your reporter spoke with Color of Change Executive Director Rashad Robinson, who talks about the reasons behind his group's anti-ALEC campaign and the continuing pressure on other ALEC member corporations to resign.
Our campaign against the American Legislative Exchange Council really started last year. We went out to our members and wanted them to educate them about voter suppression and the discriminatory voter ID laws that were popping up around the country. And as my staff and I started researching these laws and really trying to think through how we both educate our members about these laws and then also give them something to do, give them a way to raise their voices and have an impact in making sure that democracy is open to everyone, that everyone has the opportunity to participate in this upcoming election. All the fingers started pointing back to this organization in D.C., this nameless, faceless organization called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And this organization picked a name that no one kind of remembers. You'll never see their leader on television. You'll never see them on Fox News or CNN debating issues. What they do is they bring corporations and state legislators into closed-door meetings behind the scenes. And what they do is they partner them together to write these pieces of legislation that then they push out into states around the country, laws that with corporate backing get pushed out to support corporate policy. So, for instance, the Stand Your Ground law, which has become famous because it's providing the legal defense to George Zimmerman, who admitted to shooting and killing Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. The Stand Your Ground law was cooked up between the NRA and Walmart. Walmart is the largest seller of long guns. They cooked up this law behind the scenes at an ALEC meeting, along with some Florida legislatures, and then they would push this law out into states around the country to support sort of Walmart's business interests, NRA's interests, which are the interests of gun sellers who are the primary supporters and backers of the NRA. And this is just one of many examples of the way in which laws get pushed through ALEC. What we're doing in this campaign is holding corporations who sponsor ALEC accountable. 99% of ALEC funding comes through major corporations who every single day to go to black communities and all communities, in fact, and ask us to buy their services or use their products. And our question, our response to them is that they can't come and ask for our money by day and try to take away our vote by night. And that's really the goal of this campaign. So far, we've experienced some real success in the last week. Although this campaign has been going on for a number of months, but last week we found out that Coke and Pepsi and Kraft and Intuit, which, you know, is the creator of TurboTax and QuickBooks and some other software, all pulled out of ALEC and are no longer going to be sponsors. And we are working to make this part of a domino effect.
Do you see a consumer boycott as part of the tools that you'll use to put pressure on certain companies to pull out of ALEC?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of tools we're using. Right now, we're really working to sort of elevate this and make sure that everyday Americans really understand. Part of the benefit of working with ALEC for some of these corporations is that no one knows what ALEC does. So they can push these laws behind the scenes without anyone knowing, and ALEC can almost do their dirty work without it being public. Now that Americans are finding out, now that radio programs like yours and television networks and our members are raising their voice and other organizations are joining in the effort, it's no longer a behind-the-scenes proposition that these corporations are agreeing to. They're having to now have their relationship with ALEC out in the spotlight. And so, yes, we may get to a point where we're talking about consumer boycott. But at this point, what we're doing is we're now giving these corporations a choice that answers some very simple questions. Do they want to stand with the organization that promotes Stand Your Ground laws, promotes making flavored tobacco more readily accessible to young people, the promotion of the Arizona immigration law, which is also a piece of ALEC legislation, and, of course, the voter suppression, voter ID laws, which brought color or change to this issue in the first place.
Large corporations in this country have enormous power, and if ALEC were disbanded tomorrow, they might just form a new political organization and funnel lots of money to politicians as they do now through a different vehicle. And with Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, allowing big corporations to contribute unlimited amounts of money. Do you think we need to move aggressively towards a public financing system for our political elections?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think we need a new system. And I don't think it's just about ending Citizens United. Everyone knows that, you know, who's really watched the political system, that even before Citizens United, there was, you know, way too money in politics had just way too much influence in terms of what policies got presented and what policies passed. There's a lot of work to be done. And for us at Color of Change, with a central goal of empowering the voices of Black folks and their allies in this democracy, we understand that we can't do that if at every turn that money is going to trump the voices of everyday people.
That was colorofchange.org Executive Director Rashad Robinson. For more information on the campaign against the American Legislative Exchange Council, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hale and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Garrett Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.